Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new, very special episode of Uncanny Treks. I am Bob in Cascadia. That is Matt in the Southland. Last week, we finished up the Paul Dini, Destin Wynn run on Detective Comics. We had a cameo from Slam Bradley, and this is the perfect time to force Matt to read a Slam Bradley comic. I've been meaning to make him read. So we are doing Gotham Year One. It is written by Tom King. It is art by Phil Hester. I am Bob in Cascadia. That is Matt in the Southland. Matt, how are you doing this evening?
Doing great, Bob. The only thing I regret is that Slam Bradley was never on the Batman 66 show.
Oh, man. That would be great. They had that long-running Batman 66 comic.
Yes.
They really should have at least done a couple Slam Bradley issues of that Batman 66 comic. That would have been delightful.
In case you're wondering what I'm talking about, folks, when Slam Bradley hits people in these comics, it's a slam every time.
It's great. So, Matt, to begin with, Tom King, he's a controversial figure. I know one of our most devoted listeners absolutely hates him. But, Matt, what's your take on Tom?
Little controversial there, isn't he? Well, Bob, I will say that I've read a lot of Tom King. Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow is his best book, and it's like the definitive Kara Zor-El story. If you need to read a Supergirl story, what should I read? That's the one, Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow.
Yeah, it's great. Read it now, listeners, before the 2026 movie adapts it and ruins it. Read it now.
Right. And then Bobby's got the other side of the Tom King coin, Heroes in Crisis, which is absolutely terrible.
It's almost as bad as Identity Crisis, folks.
Yes.
Almost. It's one, and in fairness, I think he had to do it because they were, Tom King, it's your turn to write a crossover. But it's real bad. It's real bad.
So if we have Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow as his best, and we have Heroes in Crisis as one of his worst, if you want to look for a mediocre Tom King, Batman Elmer Fudd.
I strongly disagree there. Batman Elmer Fudd is, I would say, good or even very good.
It's average. City of Bane.
It is shockingly good. We need to do an episode on it.
I'll do an episode of it. I enjoyed it, but to me, it was just average. It was what it was.
All right. Well, we'll save that argument for the end.
So. I'm not saying it's bad. If you're listening and you're on the fence about reading it, read it.
Well, can I tell you what my midpoint Tom King title is?
Go for it, Bob.
I agree with you, Supergirl, probably number one, if not number one, near number one of Tom King. Heroes in Crisis, absolute dog crap. I would say the one that still flummoxes me is his Mr. Terrific and Adam Strange one, which actually maybe we should do that too because of the Superman movie with Mr. Terrific coming up. But that comic, I honestly don't know if it's a really great comic or if it's one of the worst comics I've ever read. I do not know. And so I want to do an episode with you and discuss it with you and see how I feel about it after that.
Well, Bob, I do know your opinion of Tom King's Killing Time, which you don't care for, but I think it's awesome.
I don't care for it. I will say I do appreciate that it does Long Halloween, but in 6 issues rather than 30. I appreciate the brevity. I'm into the whole brevity thing.
He did City of Bane, which strangely I preferred part 2 over part 1 because Tom King typically, he's very strong coming in, but then he doesn't hit the landing.
I think of that as more of a Scott Snyder problem than a Tom King problem, although it's also just generally a comics writer problem because of the nature of the medium.
Exactly, yeah. And I've read most of his Bat-Cat stuff, but I'm not as recently, so I'm not as fresh on it. But I remember finding it, it wasn't my favorite.
I do want to argue with you about Killing Time at some point, although I'm not in as much of a hurry. And then I also want to see what you think of the Tom King Penguin series, which ties into Chip Zdarsky's Batman and is a sequel to Killing Time. And I thought it was absolutely horrible, but I wonder if you might like the Penguin comic more since it's tied into Killing Time. Maybe you'll think it's horrible.
I don't know. I have to check it out. But that's my exposure to Tom King. I've read most of his stuff. You sound like you've read some of the more niche stuff.
I've read everything Tom King has written for Marvel and DC. I haven't read his Love Everlasting series for Image, but I've read everything he's written for Marvel or DC.
Well, on the art side, though, we got someone different here.
Yeah, we got Phil Hester, Matt. Do you remember his art?
Yeah, he was on Green Arrow. Didn't he draw Winnix Green Arrow?
He actually drew the first 50, 60 issues of that Green Arrow series. So he was on the Kevin Smith run. He was on the Brad Meltzer run. He was on the Jeb Winnick run. He's the source of continuity.
The Winnick run was the Riddler thing, right?
Maybe that was the one where they do 1 year later, where Ollie's the mayor of Star City.
Correct. That was Winnick. I do remember Kevin Smith's run, though. And what defines his art? The jawlines. He gives it that square line is what gives his art away.
It does kind of have a Batman the Animated Series look to it, for sure. I think Phil Hester also did the art for Mark Millar's Swamp Thing. which is just weird because that's supposed to be a very good run. I've never read it, but it's funny to imagine this Bruce Timm style on a Vertigo comic, on a Swamp Thing horror comic. Well, Matt, were you surprised that our comic here for today, the 6 issues of Gotham Year One, were you surprised that it was set in the early 60s? Usually when you use Slam Bradley as a character and you kind of go back to the roots of Batman, you think film noir, you think 1930s, 1940s, but here we're doing early 60s.
All right, Bob. I didn't really understand why it was early 60s, because I'm struggling to understand the timeline primarily, because I know that Slam Bradley had a relationship with Catwoman. Is this non-canonical? Well,
clearly, I don't understand the new DC universe, but either this is out of continuity or that the Catwoman-Slam Bradley thing no longer happened.
Gotcha. I just want that Slam Bradley-Catwoman thing to happen, Bob.
I like that romance a lot, but I don't know if that Catwoman series, after the New 52, I don't know if it would, quote, count anymore.
Right, especially with the Black Mask stuff, too.
I don't know where Holly's at as a character. I wish that stuff still counted in the sense that I really like that Catwoman series, but yeah. I don't know. What goes down in issue number one? I got number one.
Bob, Slam Bradley is given a letter to deliver related to the recent disappearance of Gotham's princess, Helen Wayne, who is Bruce's aunt.
You didn't know Batman had an aunt, although we'll find out, actually, he doesn't have an aunt.
Aunt Harriet, Bob.
Aunt Harriet. Isn't she supposed to be Dick's aunt?
I don't have a clue, Bob. I don't know. There's just some woman living up in Wayne Manor. I didn't understand it. I thought that was just so they could be, okay, there's a woman living there. They're not all gay.
That is why they did.
I'm not even really going to justify it. I know why that woman was there.
She was there to police it. Well, Matt, what goes down on your favorite panel?
Well, Bob, my favorite panel is actually on page one. There's this newspaper that gives you the setting. I love it when they do that. They say this is 1961. This kid is missing. It's a Wayne. We're set in Gotham. I just thought it was a great way to quickly stage the story. And this is so similar to the crime of the century, Bob.
Like Matt's saying, it's similar to the Lindenberg kidnapping, Matt. You want to catch our listeners on what the Lindenberg kidnapping was if they don't know.
So the famous pilot Charles Lindbergh's baby was kidnapped and a ransom note was sent out. But then the baby was found dead like 2 months later. And that's pretty much the plot of the story. Yeah, I mean, with just involving the Waynes and Slam Bradley.
I think some conspiracy theorists say that wasn't actually the baby. But I think that's more the realm of conspiracy. Yeah. If you're interested in it, there actually is a pretty good comic. There's a guy named Richard Geary who does black and white true crime graphic novels about famous 19th and 20th century murder cases. And he has one about the Lindbergh baby kidnapping that's pretty good. I like Geary.
True crime comics need to come back.
Matt Lex is from hell. So that was your favorite panel. I guess I wanted to start by asking you any thoughts. We've emphasized this, but any thoughts on the Wayne family names? We figure out that Bruce's grandfather is Richard Bruce. We figure out that his grandmother is Constance. And we figure out that his aunt is Helen Wayne.
Okay, so Richard made me immediately think of Grayson.
It's funny because we just read that Devin Grayson Gotham Knights arc where you have the ghost of Batman's parents arguing with the ghost of Nightwing's parents.
Right.
Batman's parents are being racist, anti-Romani to Nightwing's parents. So it's funny that Batman's grandfather would have the same name as Nightwing's father.
What's so strange, too, is technically Dick has been adopted by Bruce. Dick Wayne. All right. But then Helen Wayne, Bob. We know Helena was the Huntress in the Silver Age. Yeah. So is she supposed to be named after?
We know from the Bat-Cat series that Matt didn't love that Tom King has a lot of time for Helena Wayne as Batman and the Catwoman's daughter, right? Well, Matt, I did want to say, were you a little surprised that the kidnapper's letter had a bat mark there at the end?
Oh, my. It was a bit too on the nose, Bob. And you're going to see that throughout this comic. And I get it's called Gotham City Year One. So we're going to be learning about how this came to be.
As an aside, I would just say my favorite panel was, and this is something that I go to a lot in Batman comics, it turns out, but we see two creepy gate statues in front of the Wayne Manor that look much like the statues you might see in Mask of the Phantasm. I always like a creepy statue in a Batman comic. So that's my favorite panel.
I'm glad you like this as your favorite panel because I didn't care for Wayne Manor's architecture for some reason. It looked like a community coffin. I always imagined it during the 60s, it was more like an estate and not so much with all these like paneled windows.
I'd have to go back and look at the architecture. I was more fixated on statues by the gate. And then, Matt, we've already referenced this, but we have the reveal at the end of this issue that it's Slam Bradley telling this story to Batman about his grandparents and his dead aunt. And were you surprised that that's the revelation of Slam telling this to Batman?
They had to include him somehow. Research shows that comics set in Gotham City tend to sell better when Batman does make an appearance.
Going on to issue number two, Matt, what goes down in issue number two of Gotham Year One?
As the GCPD tries to put the kidnapping on Slam, he tries to meet with the kidnappers to exchange the ransom money.
Matt, do you like the irony in this issue that Gotham is bigger yet safer than Metropolis in the early 1960s?
I do, Bob, especially with the hard-nosed commissioner who's only had to solve 6 murders in a calendar year. Where's Green Lantern, Bob?
Oh, that's a good point. In New 52, they're a different Earth, right? No Green Lantern anymore. You could also say he would still be 40s, right? So he's retired by this point, and maybe he's one of the reasons Gotham is so safe.
What I heard, Bob, is he was in Metropolis.
Ooh, that's just a visit, Matt. That's just a visit. Hush, establish that. So my favorite panel of this issue is we see Batman's granddad pointing the white outline of a revolver at Slam, and Slam is bathed in red light. I thought that was a cool page of art by Phil Hester.
The artwork in this is fantastic. Well, the art in this is gritty, but it's on the mark. I love it.
One thing you got to say about Tom King comics is whatever you think about the writing, and for me, they're way up, way down. My man gets great artists. His artists are always great. It's interesting that this comic likes to present characters and then not give their names or really withhold their names. So they give the hard-nosed police commissioner that Matt just described, but I don't think we actually learn his name until a newspaper story at the very end of this miniseries. And yes. I can't even remember what it is. So it's an aside.
Well, that's a good point you just made there, because when I was picking my favorite panel, I was looking for his name and could not find it. So I just called him Commissioner.
In the reporting on it, on him getting beaten up in what will be Crime Alley, we'll get to that.
And also the woman you're about to describe, who is the messenger who delivers the letter, she calls herself Sue at one point, but I think that's all we only hear one time.
Yeah, she calls herself Sue. And then later, much, much later after this issue, Slam Bradley figures out her name is Queen. For large swaths of the issue, she's just not called anything. You assume Sue is just a fake name she gives Slam.
But even Queenie sounds like a stage name for her jazz stuff. You don't really know her name.
Queenie seems to be somewhat modeled on the 1960s Eartha Kitt Catwoman. Not totally, but she's African-American, like Eartha Kitt. She's a little bit of a stage dancer, stage performer, which I think Eartha Kitt also was.
And she also jumps from buildings like Catwoman. So on the nose. Those moments made me cringe a little bit. Do we need a Catwoman character here? Because the only thing I know about Slam Bradley is that he slammed Catwoman.
There's two ways that you can go with a prequel, right? You can literally say, oh, this is why this thing is this way. Or you can just have things that are broadly similar to current stories, but just happen in the past. They do a little bit of both. They explain why some things are this way, but they also just have things. As far as I can tell, we're not supposed to understand that this character, Queenie, has any direct influence on why things are the way they are in current Batman. She's just a character who's an interesting parallel.
Bob, you notice some Court of Owls type stuff, which goes into the mythos.
The other big foreshadowing is we have what seems to be a Court of Owls owl on the grave of what would be Batman's great-grandparents, Richard's parents, John and Mildred.
The baby, Helen, has an owl on her blanket. Which is just a weird choice.
Really emphasizes some of the later issues.
Right. You see it in several different panels with this blanket. It's crazy. But my favorite panel, though, was that I like that panel with Richard slumped into the grave marker. It's foreshadowing. Mm-hmm. You do see, like you said, the owl.
What goes down in issue number three, Matt?
So Slam hunts down the woman who took the ransom, which leads him to a grave where he finds the body of Helen Wayne.
My favorite panel is early in this issue, we see a flashback of why Slam is no longer a Gotham cop. And we see a pretty horrific scene where a white detective accidentally shoots a black guy's hand as a part of an intimidation strategy in an interrogation. Slam Bradley just sees red, and specifically in this red flashback, this red-colored flashback, we see Slam headbutting the detective. It was a really great panel.
Well, Bob, we do find out something about Batman's granddad, which is fascinating to me.
Do you find this as funny as I do, Matt, that Batman's granddad is a racist wife beater?
It was 1961. One thing we do find out, Bob, about the Waynes, though, which was interesting to me, is that Constance actually held the purse strings and that he was not the one who was the breadwinner or the one who brought in all the money. He'd wasted their fortune.
I don't think we find out what Constance's maiden name is, but I think it's said in a later issue that the quote-unquote Wayne Enterprises is running off of her money.
Her inheritance. It's not actually the Wayne money. That was interesting to me.
Did you catch how they have, like, the association of talking clowns with grandmother? And to me, that seems very much a nod to, in the Flashpoint universe, Martha Wayne is the... Now, obviously, that's a broad parallel, right? I don't think there's a literal connection. It is definitely what King and Hester were going for.
It was a wink and nod type thing.
For sure. And speaking of reveals, Matt, we get a big reveal about Slam's mother.
Yeah. I mean, this is fascinating to me because there's a lot of racial tension in this comic. Okay? Because it is 1961. You're in America. You're in a city setting. And we haven't really talked too much about this, but part of what Richard wants to do is build this chemical plant in Southern Gotham. And in order to do it, people don't want him building down there. They don't want it.
A lot of
environmental pollution. And this is a poorer part of the town.
North is rich, white side of town.
South is not. Yes. But Wayne is moving into South Gotham to set up industry, trying to act like he's going to help the people. But in reality, we find out that's not the case.
Interesting scene where he's being very racist. To Slam, but with Slam, where he's, oh, Slam, you work on the South Side. You seem to know these, basically, he says, colored folks or something to that.
Right.
He's like, yeah, can you help me not have problems with them? And so it's interesting foreshadowing of what you're about to get to.
Right. And it's interesting. And you find out that Slam's mom is a black. We find out from his backstory that his brother was murdered by the local priest at the local precinct to infiltrate that precinct to figure out what happened. Slam joins the police force. But when he gets the application, he can either put white or black. And in his mind, he put white because he knew that would get him on the force.
Which is really interesting to have Slam be a black guy or a mixed race guy who's passing as white. Then it's also especially ironic because, Matt, have you ever read the first Slam Bradley story in Detective Comics number one?
No, I never have.
It's super, super racist.
Oh.
It's Slam Bradley beating up a bunch of very racistly drawn Chinese guys. Super racist. And so there's a really interesting irony. I know Tom King has read it. I think that's the only Golden Age Slam Bradley story I've read. And that's the one most people have read, if they've read one. So I know Tom King has read some of those. And so I think he was conscious of, as cool as Slam Bradley is as a character, and I agree, I think he's a great, cool character. He does have this really racist history. And so this is an interesting way to repackage that by having him be a mixed race guy passing as white.
That makes sense. Yeah, I didn't know that at all. So this is kind of a strange question, but you said he was racist towards Asian people. Chinese. So this character is not going to be racist towards Chinese, is he, Bob? Like, how weird would that be if the modern... racist to Chinese people, even though he went through all the trouble of building up this backstory to make him not racist towards black people.
There's a funny irony or funny tension there. And I think it's also just worth pointing out, too, that it's interesting that people love to complain about race swapping today, right? But we have this classic example in the 60s of Catwoman gets, quote unquote, race swapped. She's played by two white actresses, Julie Newmar and Lee Merriweather, but she's also played by a black actress in Batman 66, Eartha Kitt, and nobody complains about that. And so it's interesting that this comic that's dealing with hiding racial identity or passing mutability of racial identity also does have this callback to black Catwoman. It's not made a huge thing of. It's also interesting that, like you were saying, Matt, the thing everybody knows Slam Bradley for today is that in the late aughts, he had a romance with Catwoman.
He went deep with the character. Well, Bob, my favorite panel in this issue is when Slam finds this crying baby. After going to a house that it's supposed to be Sue's Harps, Queenie's home. It's supposed to be where she's living with her brother. He knocks on the door, hears a crying baby. He thinks it's the princess of Gotham, and he busts in there, beats the crap out of the dude, goes upstairs, gets shot at a couple of times, goes in and finds that it's not the princess of Gotham, but probably the daughter of this guy he just beat the crap out of.
It's a really interesting fake out because the baby and the guy that Slam beats the crap out of are black. And
so yes.
Slam's first thought is, oh God, I'm becoming the racist cop that I wanted to not be. But then what happens, Matt?
Well, then Bob, he looks out the window and he sees in the grass, there's a shallow grave. Goes and digs it up, and who does he find but the princess of Gotham, Helen Wayne, dead.
Batman's aunt, baby. She's never going to grow up to be Aunt Harriet.
So she was buried there at that home. We don't know by who, and we don't know why.
Very macabre. Well, Matt, what goes down in issue number 4?
Well, Slam confronts Richard Wayne, he bangs Constance Wayne, and he beats the tar out of the commissioner in the yet-to-be-named Crime Alley.
Did you like in this issue you saw Batman's granddad, Richard Bruce, has a menagerie of taxidermied animals? Did you like his collection?
It's quite creepy, but the hippopotamus sticks out because it looks so cartoonish. To me, it doesn't even look like a real hippo.
Matt, did you pick up from this issue that Slam might be Batman's real granddad?
He could be, which is that part of this year one in Gotham?
It is something that the comic doesn't really go into, but I do think it is meant to leave open this suggestion that Slam might actually be Bruce's granddad, since there's nothing that would forbid you from thinking that Richard knocked Constance up before, spoilers, he dies later in this comic, but they don't have a close relationship. I mean, you could also just read it as like Constance is opportunist and she gets somebody to make her pregnant, right? It doesn't necessarily even have to be Slam, but it is interesting that it introduces this ambiguity into Batman's ancestry. And just to make a point, I don't know if you followed this news coverage about the most recent Pope, Matt, but his family moved from New Orleans to Chicago. And in New Orleans, they were Creoles, which means they were thought of as black. And then they moved to Chicago and they just started identifying as white. If you have like light skin, it's common for people to cross the color line, especially in segregated America, and just say, I'm white.
Bob, did you have a favorite panel?
Yeah, I did like, there's the famous scene in Batman Year One where Gordon beats Flask Bat. And here we have a good inversion of that, where it's Slam Bradley beating the commissioner of police with a bat and making Slam the real Batman.
That was my absolute favorite scene. That part, the way it was drawn, that was my favorite panel as well.
Well, then the other interesting thing I wanted to call out is that Constance, Batman's grandmother, is talking about Richard wanting to build a Wayne Chemical Cathedral in South Gotham, which I thought was an interesting Batman 89 reference. We're going to see the stuff with Ace Chemical later in this series.
Right.
And also the famous role of the cathedral in Batman 89. So it was interesting that this miniseries was putting itself so much in conversation with Batman 89.
When I read that line, Bob, I did not put that together.
It's sort of a metaphor, right?
Yeah.
It's a monument to his wealth or monument.
Issue number 5, Bob, Slam learns that Johnny, his former employee, was killed by Richard Wayne after he confronted his lover, Sue, about her involvement with the kidnapping of Helen.
Matt, have you ever seen the movie The Maltese Falcon? It's a really great Humphrey Bogart movie, and it's about Humphrey Bogart investigating the murder of his partner, who's an absolute scumbag. And the scene where Johnny gets the tables turned on him by Sue and eventually Richard is not exactly the same, but pretty similar to what happens to Bogart's partner in The Maltese Falcon. Sorry, spoilers. And is also just an interesting callback. On the one hand, we see Slam, Sam be so affectionate towards Johnny, relatively speaking. But then, yeah, we have Johnny just be such an absolute garbage bag.
That's further reiterated by Slam later on when he doesn't even shed a tear for Johnny's death, even though Johnny had been his employee for how many years? At least 10.
My favorite panel of the issue, emphasizing Johnny is trash, Matt, is Batman's granddad Richard and Queenie kissing on top of a dirt mound in Johnny's body.
Well, Bob, my favorite panel comes later in the issue when Slam throws the Wayne's private security guy out of the window of his home. He lands on top of Slam's car, and then Slam proceeds to drive the car around town with the guy on top of the car and takes him to a junkyard. That whole sequence of panels was awesome. Well-drawn action sequences.
Nice. And Matt mentions in his notes that they go down Janson Avenue, which is the thing that Tom King always does in his Batman comics, is every street is named after a Batman writer or artist.
There's one issue where Slam's like telling you every single turn he's making on every single road, and there's 20 different Batman writers. You enjoy that if anybody goes back and reads through that.
It goes down in the final issue.
In this final issue, Bob, we discover the baby's death was an accident, that Constant murders Richard, and that Sue leaves Gotham.
My favorite panel is relatively early on. First, over the death of Helen Wayne, the Princess of Gotham on the South Side, there's a race riot where the whites from the North are burning down parts of South Gotham, the black side of town. And a part of that is we see a neon jazz sign burning, which I thought was a cool visual image.
We learn the origins of, this is Gotham City Year One, so we need to learn some origins of some other things. We learn the origin of the Batcave, Bob.
Yeah, Matt, did you like that the Batcave originated as Batman's granddad's sex trophy room?
No, Bob, I did not like that. In fact, it really made me not like the Batcave anymore and not want to even think about the Batcave for a long time.
But it doesn't really enrich your sense of his trophy room, of the T-Rex statue and the dead Robin costumes and the villain's mask and the giant penny and the freeze gun. You don't like that knowing that the origin of that was Batman's grandfather was hanging up a bunch of pairs of panties from women he may have sexually coerced?
According to Constance Wayne.
It adds a certain something. We really like that Hush fight in the Batcave from last week, Matt. You think about that, but what was going down 80 years before? Well, Batman's granddad was taking women down there.
Having his way with the servants, having his way with people, then taking their pictures, putting their panties in his face, sniffing them.
Grim, and we are making light of this, but I do appreciate it on the level of usually people portray the Waynes as like, such a noble, great family, and their legacy means so much to Gotham. Although I know recently with the Court of Owls and recently with that game, recently people have been troubling that. But I do like making the Wayne scumbags. I find that refreshing.
What do you about when, like, remember when Azrael and Jean Paul, they crawl through the Batcave to get to the part where she obviously fell down that hole that they end up unveiling to, like, the light shines down. Night's End, Azrael was having to take off his armor. He was walking through porn. He was pushing aside panties and stuff to get there.
I like to think that Azrael, like, found some of the panties and was wearing them as a part of his Azbat outfit.
What we should do is go back and get that image where, like, you see Azrael still wearing the helmet and he can't see because the light's shining through and he has to take before he takes the helmet off. And we should put, like, pictures of women of that time in the background.
Did you catch that Batman's grandma made a reference to the movie The Dark Knight? Bit about the hero got.
I did get the Ace Chemical reference, though, Bob. Apparently, Richard Wayne is responsible for creating the Joker, technically.
Yeah, so explain that reference to the listeners, Matt.
The whole Wayne chemical thing doesn't work out too well, so they end up selling it to a different company, and an Ace takes over.
And then that becomes the source of at least the Joker.
The Joker falling into the vat of chemicals, turning. And then also, Bob, Slam Bradley was supposed to be a mentor for young Thomas Wayne, and he didn't do that. So Thomas got his ass handed to him in an alley, which led to Batman. Well,
can I tell you one other connection I just now made?
What?
So in the notes, I put the Ace reference. Initially, looking at my note, I didn't remember what I meant by that. I meant Ace Chemicals.
Ace the Bat-Hound.
And then I realized, oh, Batman named his dog after the chemical company.
That's like really weird, Bob.
I don't think the comics have ever been aware of it. I don't think that's an intentional thing, but think about it. When one of us does our Batman run, Matt, we have to explore why Ace the Bat-Hound is named after
the Identical Corporation.
Scott Snyder needs to get on that.
Tom King is setting up a gift for Scott Snyder there. That's the new revelation I just had as I was misreading my own notes. I think this is an appropriate summary to this comic, which I like a lot, actually, and to our rather random discussion of this comic that I think does do some really interesting things with racism, corruption, class divide, etc. But when Batman's talking to Slam in the epilogue, Slam's an old man who's dying, and Batman asks, what does it mean? And Slam, like, it doesn't mean anything. It's just something that happened a long time ago.
Yeah. Do you think Slam's a reliable narrator, Bob? Do you think he's trying to make himself sound better before he dies? Maybe he really was a racist, and he's trying to make it sound
like, in these woke times, he's trying to get cultural capital by pretending to be African American.
This is his deathbed revisionist history of himself.
I like that interpretation, Matt, but the one thing I would say that mitigates against it is he does know that Batman is Bruce Wayne. How would he know that if the story isn't largely true? Although you do raise up a good point that he could be presenting it in such a way to make his own role more sympathetic.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's how I feel after reading it. When you brought up the point that the first Detective Comics issue had him in it being racist towards Chinese people, I'm like, huh. So you're right, Tom King is trying to turn him into a character that's more acceptable for this generation. Or is it just he's not a relatable narrator and he's just trying to convince Batman that he's not the bad guy and that he helped make Batman who he is? Let's talk about ranking this.
Just to orient the listeners, so far we've got a 12-item list. We've got the 12 apostles of comics here. At number one, we have the John Hickman, Steve Epting, Fantastic Four run. At number 12, we have the A.J. Lieberman, Owlbear and Gotham Knights, Hush Returns arc. Sitting at number six, we have Batman Hush by Jeff Loeb and Jim Lee. I don't really like that being there, but it's high. Sitting at 7, we have Batman Broken City by Brian Azzarello, Eduardo Risso. And sitting at number 8, we have Suicide Squad Get Joker by Brian Azzarello and Alex Maleev. Matt, on this 12-item list, where would you want to put Gotham Year One?
I want to put Gotham Year One after Batman Broken City.
I'm shocked by that, Matt. You think Batman Broken City, which you do not like and hate, is better than this?
For a hard-nosed detective story set in a noir thing like this, that Broken City was better than Gotham Year One.
Wow. Okay, so you think it's better than noir. But do you, in general, setting aside where it should go in ranking, just because you hate Broken City, do you hate this comic?
I don't hate this comic, no. I think it's a little strange. I don't hate Broken City. The story's not that bad. If you've not listened to our coverage of Hush and Broken City, go back, because you understand that my hatred towards Broken City primarily comes to where it falls in your chronology. It happened in 04 immediately after Hush. Had it happened in like 07, I probably would not care. But because it happened immediately after Hush and it ruined anything I was doing with Batman at that time, that is why I do not like it. I would put it as number 8. I put Gotham Year One, though, after it, because story-wise, I think Broken City is a better story for that hard-nosed detective thing that you love so much.
I would put this at number 5, after Batman City of Madness and above the Paul Dini Detective Comics run. I do think Batman City of Madness is maybe a little better done. This is my second time through Gotham City Year One, and I like it, but I don't like it quite as intensely as I liked it the first time I read it. I've only gone through City of Madness once, but I think City of Madness hangs together slightly better than Gotham City Year One. And I would argue that even though I'm fond of the Paul Dini, Destin Nguyen Detective Comics run at number 5, even though I'm fond of it, I think it's a little bit all over the place. There's a lot of art changes, etc. So I would say that Gotham City Year One has a cohesiveness that the Dini and Destin Nguyen run lacks on Detective Comics. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. And then with the placement of Hush, if you had your way, Hush would be at the bottom.
I'm not sure if I would put Hush below Hush Returns or above Hush Returns. It would definitely either be above or below, but I'm not sure. So if I'm saying 5 and you're saying
8,
should we just flip a coin or should we just compromise?
We could put it between Hush and Broken City as the new number 7.
That doesn't feel like a compromise to me because I hate Hush. Can we just flip a coin?
Flip a coin, Bob.
Great idea. Yes. So I have a Canadian coin here. I honestly can't tell you what type of Canadian coin it is because it is so dusty.
Well, can you identify which side is a head and a tail?
I can identify a head and a tail. It is not so dusty that I cannot identify it.
I'm calling heads.
All right, you're calling up. The cat's obstructing my throw. Move, cat. I flipped it. It's heads. So you get your wish, Matt, which is to put it at number 8 right below Batman Broken City. On the other hand, I like that it made you say nice things about Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Risso's Broken City.
That's what it boils down to, Bob. Honestly, Azzarello does what the intent is. It's just not my favorite type of Batman.
I vastly, vastly prefer Brian Azzarello as a writer to Tom King. But if I were going to say one nice thing about Tom King as opposed to Brian Azzarello, even though I do like Tom King, I would say that Tom King, a more versatile writer than Brian Azzarello. I think you do have to give Tom King that.
Oh, yes, for sure. Because this Gotham Year One compared to what he does with Catwoman, Batman, or City of Bane are so different.
My man strikes a lot of different tone. Thank you for indulging me and reading Gotham City Year One. We'll probably be back in a week or two with another extra comic in addition to our coverage of Mark Waid Fantastic Four. This is Uncanny Treks. I am Bob in Cascadia. That is Matt in the Southland. Have a great night, everybody.
Thanks for listening.